This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, with the first round of voting in the French presidential race now over, two clear candidates will now go forward into the final stage, centrist Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen. But with the polls showing Macron as favourite to become the next French president, is the final outcome a done deal? We'll be speaking to veteran Labour MP Dennis Skinner, who is arguing that the surprise announcement of a snap general election in the UK is designed to bury an ongoing investigation into allegations of expenses fraud levelled at the governing Conservative Party. UK opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn continues on the campaign trail with a speech to the Trade Union Congress in Scotland, a part of the UK where his party holds just one seat. The leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman Zahawari, released a statement on Sunday in which he called upon Sunni jihadists in Syria to wage a new campaign against Syrian leaders and the Western-led coalition. We'll be asking if this signals a comeback for Al-Qaeda. And have you ever dreamed of owning an entire town? Well, that dream could become a reality. If Oregon sounds nice, that is. Oh, and you will need $3.5 million. All that and more over the next hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. Well, some have predicted that it's all over by the shouting, but as the French presidential race enters its final stages, will the people of France choose the far-right Marine Le Pen or the safer, more centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron to be their next president? Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
Well, in the end, there were no surprises as the first round of results from the French presidential race emerged. Emmanuel Macron, the centrist presidential candidate, is now odds on to become the next president of France. Amid tight security, Macron addressed thousands of his supporters at a Paris exhibition centre, most of them enthusiastically waving the French tricolour.
The people decided to take me on to the second round of presidential elections.
The event felt more like a victory party than a political rally. Macron went on to congratulate and name all of the other presidential candidates who had stood against him.
I am humbled by this. This is a tremendous responsibility thrust upon me. I want to take advantage of this opportunity to present my greetings to all the other candidates.
Nathalie Arthaud,
François Lasminot, Jacques Cheminade, François Fillon, Nicolas Dupont-Aignan, Benoît Hamon,
Jean Lassalle,
Jean-Luc Mélenchon, Anne-Philippe Poutou.
Attentive listeners will note that Macron pointedly missed out one name, that of Front National presidential candidate Marine Le Pen, who took second place in the first round of voting and who will now join Macron in a tense but predictable final push for the presidency. And in a call for national unity, Macron went on to say he wanted to lead the country for all of the people of France and, he said, confront the threat from nationalism. A thinly veiled reference to Le Pen and the Front National that she leads.
The president of all the peoples of France, the president of the patriots, confronted with the threat of nationalism.
Addressing her own supporters in the election day headquarters in the northern French town of Hénin-Beaumont, Le Pen said she now had a duty to defend France from a list of perceived threats.
From now on, I have an immense responsibility, that of defending the French nation, its unity, its security, its culture, its prosperity and independence.
In her closing remarks, Le Pen summoned the spirit of wartime Free French leader Charles de Gaulle, adding that the only way to unite the people of France was to be led by someone who truly loved France.
In 1943, In Casablanca, General de Gaulle said, the grandeur of the people only comes from the people itself. And that is the principle which, for 1,500 years of its history, is the one that has forged the history of France. The principle that I will implement, uniting the French people, can only be done on the basis of the love of France. Long live the French people, long live the Republic, and long live France.
Meanwhile, away from the political rallies, there were widespread protests organised by anti-fascists, with thousands taking to the French streets who oppose both Macron and Le Pen. Several cars were set alight and shop windows smashed, but with security tight across France, the police were quick to take on and contain the demonstrators. France remains under a state of emergency. Last week, the sound of breaking bottles and tear gas was replaced by a much more sinister sound. The sound of the latest terrorist outrage in the heart of Paris. There had been fears last week's terrorist attack on the Champs-Élysées, in which a radicalised gunman shot dead a French policeman and seriously wounded two of his colleagues, would overshadow and even influence the French presidential result. In the end, however, Marine Le Pen's success in the first round of the presidential race did not appear to have been boosted by the attack and her tough rhetoric on security and immigration. So to discuss the result in more detail and what it means for the final weeks of the presidential race, I spoke earlier to Nick Hewlett, professor in French studies at Warwick University. Professor Hewlett, we've seen in recent times a growing dissatisfaction amongst the electorate for establishment parties, but is there anything specifically French about the results and voting pattern we're seeing emerge there following this first round of presidential polling?
You know, the French have a reputation for rebelliousness, which I suppose is on the whole merited. I mean, we have the Marine Le Pen result, of course, which is the most notable one, perhaps. But we also have the Mélenchon vote, who is on almost a fifth of the people voting who voted for him. So that's pretty high as well. So in terms of being specifically French, as you know, if you add those two scores up, plus the far left candidates and so on, you're getting on for 50% of the electorate. Which is voting in a protesting fashion.
And there were concerns last week following the terrorist attack in Paris that may be a boost to Le Pen, but the results over the weekend suggest that perhaps any benefit the Front National leader has gained has been fairly modest. How much of an influence has the current state of emergency and these terrorist attacks been to Le Pen's campaign overall?
I'm not sure about the most recent ones, the killing of the policeman on the Champs-Élysées, but there's certainly been a cumulative effect over the past couple of years, 230 people killed, something like that, in terrorist attacks. And certainly Marine Le Pen has been saying she'll almost halt immigration completely, priority to people of French nationality in terms of jobs, benefits, and so on and so forth. I think the general climate created by the terrorist attacks has helped Marine Le Pen. I think part of the reason she didn't benefit a bit more was that she made one or two what might be described as gaffes in the last few days of campaigning. She sought to absolve France of responsibility for the state, anyway, for deporting Jews to their death in Germany in the Second World War, for example. That was probably the most notable one, which was very reminiscent of comments that her father used to make along the same lines. And on the whole, she has managed to avoid saying such things, but certainly that counted against her, I think.
And she's had a fairly strong showing so far, but do you think the perceived threat from Marine Le Pen was overstated by both her political opponents and the national and international mainstream media?
You know, the extent of the threat in terms of if she becomes president would only become clear if she became president. You know, she's gone through this, what's being called a de-diabolization movement. In other words, trying to soften, I suppose, the Front National somewhat and make it less objectionable. And certainly whether that has actually happened would only become clear if she became president, I suppose. In terms of the electoral threat, clearly she's an electoral threat in the first round because she's got through to the second round, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that she will become president, because the transfer of votes is very much going, you know, for the people who lost in the first round, very much going to Macron. Mélenchon is not, as far as I know, has not stated his preference for second round voting, but it's very, very unlikely that there are going to be many Mélenchon voters who will vote Marine Le Pen. There might be a few, but I don't think there are going to be very many. Fillon supporters, what's that, nearly another 20% of the people who voted will almost all, I think, vote Macron. One of the first things he said when he conceded defeat was that people should vote, his supporters should vote Macron, therefore against Le Pen. So in terms of Marine Le Pen winning the presidency, it's extraordinarily unlikely.
And are we likely to see the wider political debate in France moving further to the right following Le Pen's showing in these elections?
I think it's inevitable. That some of the positions that she's taken on immigration, on the euro, on Europe more broadly, on law and order, on increasing the size of the police force, are going to be taken more seriously, yes. You know, if people are serious enough about these issues, responsive enough about these issues to vote in large numbers, let's face it, for Marine Le Pen, I think, yes, these issues are going to be taken more seriously. In 2002, when Marine Le Pen's father got through to the second round, this was seen as a complete aberration, terrible shock, something which would, you know, for many people anyway, hopefully never happen again. Whereas this time, the polls have been predicting this result for a long time, for a good 6 months and more. So yes, I think certainly those issues on the agenda will be more on the agenda than they have been.
There will be many pro-EU politicians across the continent sighing with relief. How much of a factor was the question of the European Union and dissatisfaction with the EU during this election?
I tend to think that the EU has been a bit more of a hook to hang other things on, really. I don't think the EU is the issue as it is in Britain, for example. I mean, Marine Le Pen at one point was saying, this was, you know, 6 months, a year ago, that if she won, there'd be an immediate referendum to leave the EU. This has been watered down somewhat to a referendum to come out of the euro. Mélenchon at one point was talking about leaving the EU, and again, he seems to have dropped that in the later stages of the campaign. I think probably that a stronger pro-European or pro-EU feeling in France than it might seem. I mean, agriculture, for example, which is still quite important in France. France is still a very rural country. Agriculture has benefited enormously from the EU, and France has been, you know, right at the heart of the EU. And many people remember or will have been taught at school that the EU has prevented recurring war between France and Germany, and has even created a great deal of friendship. So I think even the extreme right is a little bit wary about the European question.
And one of the big casualties in this election has been the French Socialists, with Benoît Hamon securing just 6.2% of the vote. Given this is their heaviest defeat in presidential elections since 2002, where do French Socialists go from here? Is there an opportunity in June's parliamentary elections?
June's parliamentary elections will be very interesting, I must say. If we assume that Macron wins them for a moment, wins the presidential elections for a moment, how is he going to recommend that people vote in the parliamentary elections? That is a very interesting question. Now, whether locally we'll see a bit of a resurgence of the socialist, I would imagine we will, yes. Hollande himself has been a very unpopular president, quite a lot more unpopular even than Sarkozy, according to the opinion polls. But in the regions, there are lots of MPs, deputies, who are doing very strong constituency work, for example, who have a lot of support at the local level. So I don't think we'll see a complete rout of the socialists in the parliamentary elections. As I say, Macron was in the Socialist Party, 18 months ago. He was economics minister, as you know, and advisor to Hollande and so on and so forth. So he has close associations with the Socialist Party. I think one of the very interesting questions is what will happen to the centre-right. But similarly, we shouldn't forget that 4 months ago, François Fillon was looking like he was going to coast to victory. And in a way, this is a sort of, well, it's more than an accident, I suppose, but it's, you know, the revelations of the alleged embezzlement of public funds released by the allegations released by the Canal Chaîne newspaper. You know, the timing was clearly deliberate. But if those hadn't existed, if we can just, you know, think of with ifs for the moment, then Fillon would be heading towards the presidency almost certainly. Now, that's a long way of saying that on the ground in the constituencies, that, again, rather like socialists, there are a lot of people who will be supporting their local centre-right candidate. So I don't think that either party, either the Les Républicains or the Socialist Party, are going to be decimated in the parliamentary elections. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting parliamentary election, particularly in terms of what Macron is going to be calling for, you know, and where will he want the Prime Minister to come from, and so on and so forth.
Professor Nick Hewlett, many thanks for joining us today on World in Focus.
Thank you very much.
And Mark Hurst joins us in the studio now. Mark, this has all obviously proved a little predictable in the end, but already some commentators are suggesting that the French presidential campaign has been unduly influenced by, surprise, surprise, Russia again.
Yes, Jack, barely a day goes by when Russia isn't accused of interfering in an election in one part of the world or another, despite the consistent inability of Russia's accusers to provide even a shred of credible evidence to back up their claims. The latest accusations were published by Politico, the political media organisation based in Arlington, Virginia, coincidentally just a short drive from the CIA's headquarters in Langley. These latest accusations
sure, what
claim,
you're trying to say there, Mark.
These latest accusations claim Moscow has been dusting off what Politico describe as the KGB's subversive toolbox. Now, that must be a lot of dust because the KGB hasn't existed for 36 years. The Politico report regurgitates a range of previously unfounded allegations against Russia and Russian hacking in the US presidential race. It's heavy on allegations but light on evidence, a pattern that we've consistently seen deployed before by US sources who regard Russia as a threat to the US.
So Emmanuel Macron is seemingly odds on to win the presidential election. I mean, does that mean that he would be Moscow's favourite candidate?
Well, no, and I think that's the point. Macron, of all of the French presidential candidates, has always been the most hostile towards Russia in terms of his rhetoric and statements. As you will remember, there is a narrative in the US, a false narrative, mainly pushed by US Democrats, that Russia influenced the US presidential election to such an extent they swung the result in favour of Donald Trump. By implication, then, the US democratic system is even more vulnerable to such influence than the French system is, because if you believe the chattering political classes, France looks set to elect a president who is the least favourable to Russian interests. The political piece includes all the key phrases, describes Sputnik and RT as fake news, describing the false claims of Russian hacking as Soviet-inspired, all key phrases designed to instill McCarthyite-type Reds under the bed's fear, and it's a distraction away from the true reality of what's really happening, which is that Western populations are growing in their level of distrust of establishment manipulation and out-and-out lies, whether it's the economy, whether it's climate change, or, importantly, whether it's war, Western establishments have consistently lied to their publics about what they are really up to. So creating a big, bad Russian bogeyman is useful in distracting the public herd away from the failing of their own governments. But when you look more closely at this particular story, you also realise it's not all that it seems. It was written by Laura Daniels. The article helpfully explains that Daniels is a fellow in the Institut Français de Relations Internationales in Paris. That body is linked to the shadowy RAND Corporation, which is based in Santa Monica. And RAND provide research to the US Armed Forces and have a multi-million dollar budget funded in large part by the US government. Daniels is also a former consultant to the RAND Corporation and was provided research for RAND on NATO strategy. I think you might therefore reasonably assume that Daniels might have provided some actual evidence to back up these claims, and the lack of it suggests that when it comes to subversive agendas, the shoe is very much on the other foot. Incidentally, we did approach Laura Daniels directly for an interview on this with the hope that she may be able to provide some of the evidence to back up her article, but she declined.
It is, of course, worth mentioning on the subject of the US election that the US population did vote for Hillary Clinton by a majority. It was actually the US system that elected Donald Trump in that instance.
Which, again, throws a spanner in the works to those who are saying that Russia has actively interfered to promote Donald Trump.
Well, Mark Hurst, thank you very much.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, we'll be speaking to veteran Labour MP Dennis Skinner, who is arguing that the surprise announcement of a snap general election in the UK is designed to bury an ongoing investigation into allegations of expenses fraud levelled towards the governing Conservative Party. We'll have that and more in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
The case for the prosecution of previous UK Prime Minister Tony Blair has come up time and time again, but each time the prosecution's case is turned down by the powers to be. Now, this month, Tony Blair is once again the firing line. However, as guests in this week's Level Talk programme point out, he's unlikely to ever be tried. Listen in to this week's Level Talk programme to find out an alternative point of view about the UK government's treatment of Mr. Blair.
By Any Means Necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us, from mass incarceration.
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter.
We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case, simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, we'll be speaking to veteran Labour MP Dennis Skinner, who is arguing that the surprise announcement of a snap general election in the UK is designed to bury an ongoing investigation into allegations of expenses fraud levelled towards the governing Conservative Party. UK opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn continues on the campaign trail with a speech to the Trade Union Congress in Scotland, a part of the UK where his party holds just one seat. We will also hopefully be bringing you some of the First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's speech at that same conference as well later on in the programme. And ever dreamed of owning an entire town? Well, that dream could become a reality, if Oregon sounds nice, that is, and you will need $3.5 million. It's almost a week now since UK Prime Minister Theresa May announced plans for a snap general election to be held in June. Since that speech last Tuesday, a variety of theories have surfaced as to the tactical reasoning behind the Prime Minister's surprise decision. But one such theory, which seems to be gaining traction, takes us back to the last general election campaign in 2015.
We are fighting for jobs. We are fighting for our economy. We're fighting for our country. We are the only people who can do it. We've come so far in the last 5 years. Let us not let it go to waste. Let's not go back to square one. Let us finish what we've begun. Let's go for it. Come on, we can do it!
It seems like an age since David Cameron took to the stump in a general election, especially given all that's happened since. The Brexit vote last June, the departure of David Cameron as Prime Minister, and the arrival of Theresa May, then the announcement by Scotland's First Minister that she wanted a second referendum on independence, and then, of course, the triggering of Article 50.
Let's keep going to build a brighter, more secure future for you, your family, and our country.
Just 2 years on from that 2015 election, which saw the Conservatives win their first overall majority in the UK Parliament since 1992, and the country is about to go to the polls for another general election. This time, a snap vote called by Prime Minister Theresa May in the name of national unity ahead of Britain's inevitable withdrawal from the EU.
Division in Westminster will risk our ability to make a success of Brexit, and it will cause damaging uncertainty and instability to the country. So we need a general election, and we need one now.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May, in her statement from last week, announcing a snap election for June the 8th. Indeed, so heavy has the rhetoric been around Brexit from Theresa May that this vote has been dubbed by many commentators as the Brexit election. But what if there was another reason for this election? What if it wasn't all about Brexit? What if there was something far more calculated and far shiftier at the root of Theresa May's decision to call an election at such short notice? You see, the governing Conservative Party has been at the centre of a legal row over election spending during the 2015 campaign. The whole row is centred around the issue of so-called battle buses. For those unfamiliar with campaign lingo, battle buses are those buses used by political parties during election campaigns. They're generally emblazoned with the party colours, logos and slogans, perfect for photo ops, and they act as a kind of mobile campaign HQ too. But in the UK, there are strict rules around exactly how much money can be spent in one area during an election campaign. It's designed to make it as fair and level a playing field as possible. And it's because of that that the UK's governing Conservative Party finds itself under investigation by the Crown Prosecution Service after 12 separate police forces in the UK
passed on files on up to 20 Conservative MPs over allegations that they broke local spending limits during the 2015 election campaign. Payments worth over £100,000 were missing, and a further £118,000 either not reported to the Electoral Commission or incorrectly reported. Effectively, the charge is that the party used its so-called battle buses to campaign in specific target seats, as well as hotel bills for visiting activists and campaign materials, massively breaching the spending limits and declaring it under national campaign spending. Now, the scandal has received a lot of attention on social media, but strangely, conventional media and political opposition have made very little noise about this. So much so that during last week's debate in Parliament on whether or not to hold a snap election, it was only Labour's veteran firebrand Dennis Skinner who put the scandal to the Prime Minister.
Will the Prime Minister give a guarantee that no Tory MP who is under investigation by the police and the legal authorities over election expenses in the last general election be a candidate in this election? Because if she won't accept that, this is the most squalid election campaign that has happened in my lifetime.
I stand by all the Conservative MPs who are in this House and who will be out there standing again, campaigning for a Conservative government that will give a brighter and better future for this country.
Labour's Dennis Skinner speaking last week in the UK Parliament, the only MP to raise the ongoing investigation into the Conservative Party's 2015 election expenses row. And Dennis Skinner joins me on the line now. Mr Skinner, you've suggested that the forthcoming election might be motivated by a desire to bury the Tory expenses investigation. If that's the case, why are we hearing so little from the government's opponents about this?
Well, it's a matter of their judgment. I mean, I raised it in parliamentary questions. I didn't get an answer from the Prime Minister, apart from the fact she said she supported 100% of all the people concerned, which means that, in effect, she supports those candidates who were involved in expenditure problems during the 2015 campaign. Now, we know that people can be thrown out of Parliament for simply being charged. And we also know that towards the end of June, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, will be making a judgment as to how many Tory MPs are involved. Now, if all 30 were involved, then, of course, Mrs. May would be losing her majority. And that's the reason why, before the end of June, i.e. on June the 8th, she is having an election with the hope that she's going to increase her majority.
Given that the Prime Minister has explicitly said, as you just pointed out there, that none of the MPs currently under investigation will be deselected and that she will stand by them, how does a snap election help that situation? Surely there would still be the need for a number of high-profile by-elections in the event that they were found guilty.
Yeah, but I mean, she's trying to influence the powers that be. She's hoping that her political decision to have the election on June the 8th will stop the Crown Prosecution Service from carrying out what they might well be doing. That's not the first time in politics that's happened, because she'd be able to say that those candidates that were supposed to have fiddled their expenses or been participating in spending too much money in their constituency have now been elected once again.
I wonder, is it fair to point the finger solely at the Conservatives on this issue of expenses fraud?
Well, we actually had one called Phil Wallis that was kicked out of office for doing less than that. He simply attacked the Liberal Democratic opponent in Lancashire and as a result lost the seat.
A lot of this centres.
Even though he'd won it.
A lot of this centres around the issue of spending on so-called battle buses. And certainly in the Labour Party, Harriet Harman's pink bus was flagged as having been used in a similar way. The SNP's Nicola Sturgeon had used a helicopter.
Why hasn't the Crown Prosecution Service or anybody else been involved in doing something about it? I mean, you're wanting to try and make it appear that it's shame on all your houses. The truth is the Crown Prosecution Service, the police, and the legal services are concerned only with those Tory MPs. Now, that is the law.
And are you confident that the Crown Prosecution Service will be able to carry on?
No, I'm not confident. I've just told you that she's having the election a week or two before the decision is made. Because if the decision was made and she was still running this government, then she would lose her majority without an election. And then there would be a vote in Parliament and the Labour leader would take over.
Would assume
that's
that
how things work in Parliament.
Were she not to return with an increased majority, she would find herself in the same situation she's in now, though.
Yeah, but I mean, she would not. She would be in power with this government and lose her majority and lose her power. She didn't have a revelation on the Welsh Hills about Brexit, because the truth is that the Brexit votes in Parliament have never been less than 30. Well, she's only got a majority of 17, so she's getting votes from elsewhere. So the idea that somehow or other she was having a hard time over Brexit is a load of nonsense.
Well, Dennis Skinner, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Yes, thank you.
Dennis Skinner there, Labour Member of Parliament for Bolsover, a constituency in the English Midlands, since 1970. And the CPS's announcement, which concerns the possible prosecution of up to 30 individuals, is currently set to fall during the general election campaign period before the election on June 8th. Turning now to other general election news, Theresa May has been lying low today, not appearing on the stump, but Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn was on the campaign trail this afternoon, delivering a speech to the Scottish Trade Union Congress, the TUC, in Scotland. Scotland is, of course, a tricky situation for Jeremy Corbyn, being as his party has only one seat north of the border. And it's a bitter story for the Labour Party too, as up until 2015, they dominated Scottish politics, but they lost 40 of their 41 seats in Parliament to the pro-independence Scottish National Party in 2015. Nevertheless, Mr. Corbyn was upbeat about his party's chances in June, and here are some of the highlights from his speech today in Aviemore in the Scottish Highlands.
I could not be at a better or more appropriate place to start our general election campaign in Scotland. We are standing for the many, not the few. And it is through our collective power in a trade union that we ensure the many standing together have the power to stand up to the rich and the powerful few. The Labour Party will always cherish, sustain and protect our relationship with the trade union movement and the working people that all of you in this hall represent. You are our DNA, you are our family, and we will never, ever apologise for the closeness of our relationship with you. Just like Keir Hardie, I'm proud to be a trade unionist. I carry my card with me wherever I go. I've been in the trade unions all my life, and I will die a trade unionist because that is what I believe in. That's why one of the very first things we will do when forming our Labour government will be to repeal the Tory Trade Union Act. Giving working people the rights to collectively organise and make their lives better, safer and more content. With the timing of the election is unexpected, the choice is very, very clear and the stakes are very, very high. Much of the media and their friends in the establishment are saying this election is a foregone conclusion. They think there are rules in politics, which if you don't follow them, you don't win. You start by doffing your cap to the powerful people, accepting their parameters so nothing can really change. Comrades, it's when you start accepting the parameters laid down by others, you can't really win. You have to challenge. Our movement knows it. It's only by us standing together as the people, for the many, not the powerful few, that we really win. We will build a new economy worthy of the 21st century. And build a country for the many, not the few. Thank you very much indeed for having me here today.
UK opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking at the Scottish TUC conference in Aviemore earlier today. And so we find ourselves now 44 days from the UK's snap general election on June 8th. In the past week, since Theresa May's announcement of the surprise vote, polling seems to reflect a spike in support for her governing Conservative Party, with three separate polls over the past few days giving them anywhere between a 21% to 25% lead on Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. Of course, with over a month to go till Brits go to the polls, there's plenty of time for all the usual pre-election gaffes and game changers, and the result of the CPS investigation into Tory expenses is certainly likely to make some sort of dent. As things stand, though, Jeremy Corbyn has an uphill battle if he has any hope of turning his party's fortunes around. All signs now point to not just a Conservative majority, but a landslide win, which, if Theresa May manages to pull it off, could see a Conservative government in London for perhaps a generation or more. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
And this is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's just coming up for 40 minutes past the hour. Now, we heard just there the UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressing the Trade Union Congress in Scotland. Also speaking at that convention today, just as we went to air, in fact, was the Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. And we can bring you a brief excerpt from her speech now, in which she outlined her support for the trade union movement, as well as criticising the governing Conservative Party and its motivations for June's snap general election.
There are some politicians, there are too many politicians, and there are also voices in the media, again, perhaps too many voices in the media, who say that politicians should shy away and governments should shy away from building strong relationships with the trade union movement, that somehow we should be embarrassed by those links. Let me say to you today clearly, I think that is flatly wrong. It is the relationships and the partnerships we have that are so essential to building the kind of country we want Scotland to be. So the relationships and the partnerships between government and the trade union movement are something we should be proud of in this country, never, ever embarrassed by. We are, of course, at the start of a general election campaign, a campaign called by the Prime Minister last week for one purpose and one purpose only, to strengthen the grip of the Tory party and crush dissent and opposition, and to do so before possible criminal prosecutions for alleged expenses fraud at the last general election catches up with her. And whatever else happens in this election, we should not allow the Tory party to escape the accountability for any misdemeanours that may have led to them buying the last general election.
Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon addressing the Trade Union Congress in Scotland in Aviemore in the Highlands of Scotland in the last hour. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's just coming up for 42 minutes past the hour.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, the leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri, released a statement on Sunday in which he called upon Sunni jihadists in Syria to wage a new campaign against Syrian leaders in the Western-led coalition. We'll be asking if this signals a comeback for Al-Qaeda. That's in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together, you ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert doubling down.
Brave New World. President Erdogan's victory in the referendum in Turkey last Sunday means that he'll soon assume serious new powers. How did this come about in a country with a long history of democracy? And is this good for Turkey or not? What does it mean for the future of secularism in the country? To find out the answers to these and other relevant questions, tune into this week's Brave New World with John Harrison.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri, released a statement on Sunday in which he called upon Sunni jihadists in Syria to wage a new campaign against Syrian leaders and the Western-led coalition. We'll be asking if this signals a comeback for Al-Qaeda. And have you ever dreamed of owning an entire town? Well, that dream could become a very real reality if Oregon sounds nice, of course, and you will need $3.5 million. Once upon a time, it was the norm for Al-Qaeda leaders Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri to release videos of themselves proclaiming jihad against the West. However, following Mr. bin Laden's assassination in 2011 and the rise of Daesh in 2014, not much has been heard from the group. But this Sunday, Mr. Zawahiri released a new recording in which he called upon Sunni jihadists in Syria to begin a fresh campaign against foreign countries involved in the country's war and to attack President Assad's men. For more on whether this could be the first sign of the return of Al-Qaeda, here's our correspondent Matthew Ayton.
The evasive leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has emerged in a recent audio recording in which he calls upon Syrian Sunni jihadists to wage a guerrilla war campaign against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his supporters, as well as Western powers. The recording was posted on Sunday, and in it, Zawahiri calls for certain Syrian rebel groups to be patient, proclaiming that they should be prepared for a battle with the US-led coalition in Iraq and Syria, as well as against Bashar al-Assad's government and Iranian-backed Shiite groups fighting alongside the Syrian president's men. Zawahiri said in the audio that, quote, "Our people in Sham, prepare yourselves for a long battle with the Crusaders and their allies, the Shiites and Alawites. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad belongs to the Alawite sect, which is an offshoot of Shia Islam. Both Alawites and Shiites are considered by Sunni jihadists to be apostates. Al-Qaeda's arm in Syria, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, previously called Jabhat al-Nusra, is widely considered to be one of the most effective opposition groups on the ground in Syria, and now leads a coalition of Islamist militant groups called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Well, joining us to discuss Zawahiri's message in more detail is Dr. Natasha Ezro, a senior lecturer of international relations at the University of Essex. Dr. Ezro, thanks for joining us here on World in Focus. So just to provide some historical context, Daesh was once part of Al-Qaeda Central, wasn't it? Can you explain that history to us briefly, please?
Well, this was a while ago. When, if we're going to go way back, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq is really the precursor of Daesh. This was led by a Jordanian named Zarqawi. But there were actually tensions very early on between Zarqawi and Osama bin Laden. And so then eventually Al-Qaeda in Iraq went on its own and became its own entity. And then it would go through a series of name changes. Islamic State in the Levant, and then eventually to the Islamic State. And the Islamic State tried to basically be the senior partner to one of Al-Qaeda's covert allies, which is Al-Nusra Front. And this didn't go over very well with Al-Qaeda's leadership, and they broke ties from one another and actually have a lot of animosity towards one another.
And what exactly were those main differences? Were they strategic or ideological or...?
A lot of it was ideological because the Islamic State was really viewed by Al-Qaeda as being too brutal. It's targeting Muslims, killing Muslims, having tactics that were going to be viewed as counterproductive and that were really giving their objectives of an Islamic government a very bad name. And they felt that these tactics were backfiring and making Al-Qaeda become more and more unpopular and weren't going to really be conducive to the cause. But the other issue was that the leadership, the new leadership under Baghdadi, Islamic State's leader, he was considered to be way too brash, way too barbaric. He was very, very egotistical, and he refused to sort of bow down to Al-Qaeda's leadership. And so it was really almost a war of egos as well.
At a time when the world is focusing on fighting Daesh in Syria and Iraq, what is Al-Qaeda up to right now? What is happening with them?
I think the world is pretty much ignored Al-Qaeda because the Islamic State has been so barbaric and so just in the media all the time with these beheadings and really extravagant displays of brutality. And so we really haven't seen or heard much about Al-Qaeda, but they've actually have been affiliated with or covertly connected with the most effective opposition group in Syria, which is Al-Nusra Front, which then turned its name to Tahrir al-Sham. And now it's part of this bigger coalition, very recently named Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. But Al-Nusra Front, it is by far the most effective militant group in Syria. And though they can't claim that they are officially associated with Al-Qaeda, there are lots of reports that the leadership is very connected with Al-Qaeda.
What I'm really interested in is the timing of Al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri's recent speech. We haven't heard from him for a while now, but he has now called upon Syrian Sunni jihadists to wage a guerrilla war against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his supporters, as well as the US-led coalition. Is there any significance in the timing of this speech, do you think?
Well, now we're seeing that the U.S. has become more involved in the Syrian conflict where it wasn't before. And so now it's trying to, it's been trying to unite all these groups together, and it hasn't been able to. In particular, there's another Salafist group, al-Sham, that's been very effective there. And it's trying to get this group to merge with it, and it hasn't really been able to do so. So I think it feels that now that there's been a little bit of a shift in U.S. policy and getting more involved in the war, that it needs to more than ever unite all these groups under one umbrella to be more effective.
And would you say that at a time when the noose is tightening around the neck of Daesh in Mosul and Raqqa, Zawahiri's speech could be a sign that he is trying to exploit that weakness and reposition Al-Qaeda as the central authority for jihadists worldwide?
Well, I think that Al-Nusra Front and the groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda have always been much stronger than Daesh in Syria. Daesh was never really had such a strong foothold in Syria as it did in Mosul, let's say, or in Iraq. It was trying to, but I think the media was misportraying the actual balance of power there. I mean, it was really the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups that were by far the most effective. I think that it's always trying to capitalize on Daesh's weaknesses, but maybe it's sensing the writings on the wall for Daesh there and that it can gain a little bit more support from other groups that might have been supporting it.
And just finally, one of the main ideological differences between Al-Qaeda and Daesh is, of course, that the former focuses on what it calls the far enemy, which is the West, while Daesh is more focused on the establishment of an actual state. Do you think it's possible that as Daesh loses more and more ground in Iraq and Syria, we will see a shift back to and a focus on Al-Qaeda's strategy?
Well, it had made a shift, in particular with the Paris attacks a couple of years ago, that it was going to move into that territory of either supporting cells in Europe or sort of Western-grown jihadis in achieving some kind of attack against the West. And what we see with Al-Qaeda, with Daesh, is a very clear response whenever it seems to be doing really poorly. at least in Iraq, it starts to turn to suicide bombings and more spectacular types of events, acts of terrorism. And I don't see why there might not be, especially with the French election going on, some... they could be lone attacks that are sort of affiliated, loosely affiliated with Daesh, but I think we're going to see some spectacular types of acts of terrorism definitely in the areas in the Middle East, and they're going to try to appear to be connected with any kind of terrorist event against the West that takes place anytime soon.
Okay, Natasha Ezro, thank you very much for your time.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
And finally, the tiny little town of Tiller in southwestern Oregon isn't somewhere that's ever hit the headlines particularly. So why is it creating such attention right now? Well, the entire town is up for sale. For a cool $3.5 million, you could buy the entire town, which comprises six houses, a shuttered general store, and a petrol station. That's a gas station for our American listeners. It's effectively a ghost town, but with a population scattered around the surrounding mountainside, as well as a few bears. And, a mobile phone signal is apparently a 30-minute drive away. So food for thought there. That's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. And in just a moment, we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. Until tomorrow, though, from me, Jack Foster, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
The case for the prosecution of previous UK Prime Minister Tony Blair has come up time and time again, but each time the prosecution's case is turned down by the powers to be. Now, this month, Tony Blair has once gained the firing line. However, as guests in this week's Level Talk programme point out, he's unlikely to ever be tried. Listen in to this week's Level Talk programme to find out an alternative point of view about the UK government's treatment of Mr. Blair.
Tom Hartmann. This is the Tom Hartmann programme.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they send me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
What do the Statue of Liberty, Hollywood horror movie, and a tiny spectrographic sensor have in common? They were all crowdfunded. And while the lady enlightening the world has been a complete project for quite a while now, you can still help other great causes. Listen to our new series, Crowdfunding with All Our Powers Combined, right here on Radio Sputnik.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day right here on Radio Sputnik.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunde, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
We increased activities in Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in.